TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara, wishing you a very happy 2014. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing to say things to you on the radio instead. I almost said internet, but we're not on the internet. We're on the radio.
We're on the internet, too.
I guess we are. It's both. Internet and radio.
21st century.
Joining me in the studio is Observer staff writer Melissa Del Bosque. Hello, Melissa.
Hello.
Also with us is Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels. Welcome, Patrick.
Hello, thanks.
Patrick, I want to talk about Mexican-American history.
Me too.
Can we do that?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
Okay, so this is a story that we just put on our website today, but it comes out of the January issue of The Observer, which you can all pick up at your favorite local bookstore.
Get the plug in early. Good job.
The story begins with a State Board of Education's meeting back in November. Which is a pretty exciting moment, as these things go, I guess. Just a few blocks away from the board meeting, there was a protest on the UT campus. A bunch of folks were upset that the Young Conservatives of Texas chapter at UT had planned to stage a catch an illegal immigrant game, which somebody thought was a good idea, and everybody quickly told them was not a good idea.
No.
And they canceled that their little game shortly after. The word kind of leaked out about it. But a guy named Tony Diaz, who's an author and an activist in Houston, was there for the protest, and then he came over to the State Board of Education's meeting to argue for Mexican-American studies courses in Texas public schools. And he mentioned this protest had just been at. It's a pretty good example of why, you know, how a little more cultural sensitivity in Texas schools probably could go a long way. And so he made his pitch to the board, and they sort of considered it. And the timing was interesting because there's a new law in place in Texas schools that kind of shook up how a lot of things work, and there are a lot of new courses opening up. The board right now is deciding what new courses to add in public schools because of these new graduation requirements that went into effect at the start of this school year. And so it's kind of wide open, and one of the things that the schools are going to be graded on now, thanks to this new law, that they weren't before, is sort of on community engagement and building what they have in their schools around the needs of their communities. And so what Diaz was saying was that this is a great opportunity to have Mexican-American history, Mexican-American literature as part of the course offerings in the school, not a requirement necessarily, but like a specifically mentioned in the course offerings. Specifically because more than half of Texas public school students are Latino or Latina.
Right.
And so, you know, he's saying, you know, if you want to talk about cultural relevance in education, this is something that's really lacking right now that we need. And a lot of board members seem kind of iffy on this idea. You can create these courses if you want in your school, and some schools do have them, but it's not created, you know, by the state. There aren't state standards for this stuff necessarily. And there's not a whole lot of guidance for districts that could do it, but in fact, at the end of that board meeting, there was a call for like a wish list of what the state board wants to have developed, by TEA, the state agency that you know kind of leads the new course development.
Right.
And a new member from El Paso sort of nominated Mexican American history as one of the courses that were listed, and it seems like that was enough to sort of, it's out there as a possibility now. The state is going to be looking at how to develop a Mexican-American history course for public schools, which is something we haven't had before and people have been asking for a pretty long time. So it's in the early stages now, but it's kind of a remarkable development. I guess I'd also say, I mean, this is Ruben Cortez in El Paso, who's a new state board member. He proposed this Mexican-American history course. And right away, some board members came back to him and said, well, if we're going to have Mexican-American studies, then we may as well have African-American studies and Irish studies and whoever else wants studies, and it's just going to be crazy, which is sort of a typical argument for this
right,
kind of stuff.
Right, that's always the response that they give.
Right, yeah. I mean, well, you know, if you care about your history, what if I care about my history, you know, just as much, and why don't we, you know, have, you know, this was Ken Mercer, who's a Republican from San Antonio. Just after Cortez made his brief pitch for this, said, well, you know, we got a wish list here. How about history of the State Board of Education with emphasis on District 5 heroes? course.
This is ridiculous.
Mercer represents District 5, so it'd be a pretty short list.
Of course.
And somebody get that man a cape.
So, I mean, it's a wish list, but Mexican-American Studies is at least on this list now, and you know, somewhere in there, the state is going to be looking at developing this course, which is a pretty huge step.
So does this mean it's going to happen for sure, or just that it's being looked at?
I think there are some rules to be worked out, and the board is going to get back to this in their meetings later this month in January. It's still kind of up in the air, but my sense from Cortez and from Diaz as well is that it's at least on this list was a huge step, so there will at least be some sort of course designated by the state that districts can pick out and choose to get if they want.
It's amazing that they're just having this conversation now.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the first time this has come up, but it's sort of, I think, kind of a, you know, an unexpected outcome of this new law that kind of just shook up everything about how high school graduation works and new course requirements. And it created this big opening that these folks are taking advantage of.
Melissa, I understand you have a story for us about Sheriff Trevino.
Yeah, for the last year, I've been following this big corruption case in the sheriff's department down in Hidalgo County on the border, and this case just keeps getting bigger and bigger. It's the second largest law enforcement agency on the border. It's you know, there's 800 employees, more or less. And in December 2012, a series of indictments came down from the FBI and the DEA. And what they found was that the sheriff's son had been running this rogue task force called the Panama Unit, and they had been ripping off local drug dealers and then reselling the drugs and offering protection for dealers who were shipping drugs north. And this had been going on for actually some time. It wasn't actually even that much of a secret to law enforcement and to the drug world in the valley. They knew about this for some time before he was finally indicted, along with the son of the Hidalgo police chief, the city of Hidalgo, and five other deputies from the sheriff's department. And then there was another a series of indictments. Two more deputies were indicted. And now this brings us up to December of 2013, where we get another big indictment, which is Commander Joe Padilla, who is known as the right-hand man of the sheriff. And so he's been indicted on money laundering and drug smuggling charges.
And so what's the significance of this in terms of the greater story of Sheriff Trevino?
Well, the sheriff is a pretty fascinating person. He's a great politician, very, very good politician. This is his, he first went into office, he's first elected sheriff in 2005. I think he's serving his third term now, and he won his reelection with, I think, 80% of the vote.
Wow.
So he had a lot of popularity in Hidalgo County. And he's always been very friendly with the media. A lot of the media liked him, including myself. I mean, I thought, you know, he seemed like a great guy, gives you a cell phone number. He seems to be very open and transparent. He's a sheriff on the border who has a lot of influence. He was appointed by Homeland Security as chair of a special border committee to look at security issues, and he's also a law enforcement official who doesn't really get into the rhetoric about border spillover or under attack, which some of the other sheriffs have really gotten into. You know, this really kind of sensationalistic kind of rhetoric, and he's never been like that. So it was a real surprise to anybody who wasn't in law enforcement or drug smuggling to hear about what happened to his son, and then the other police officer who was the police chief's son, and then the deputies, and so far the sheriff has been sort of untouched by what's been going on in the department with the indictments, and he's come out and said over and over again, "I had no idea what my son was up to. I had no idea, you know, that this was going on within my agency. That doesn't mean that I'm out of touch. It's just that these things happen in areas that where drug smuggling is really prevalent. It's happened in LA, it's happened in New York, and these things happen. But at the same time, you know, law enforcement people have told me that Commander Padilla, who was recently indicted, was very close to the sheriff and was really instrumental in his campaigns and really was sort of functioned as a spokesperson or an enforcer within the department for the sheriff. The sheriff has really distanced himself from Padilla. He came out in a recent local radio show down there right after Padilla was indicted, and he said, you know, I don't have right-hand men. I don't have, you know, he works for me, but he doesn't speak for me. Right. So he really distanced himself and fired him a couple of days after he was indicted. But there was an interesting trial in August where one of the deputies involved in the scandal chose to go before a jury. Everyone else pled guilty, so they wouldn't go before trial, but one of the officers actually did go up for trial, and they brought the sheriff in and put him on the stand. And a lot of witnesses, eyewitnesses, and so forth, and a lot of information came out about Padilla's connections with the sheriff and his influence on the deputies and so forth. So and at that point, the judge actually said, you know, that Padilla is under investigation by the U.S. attorneys. And
it's a helpful little bit of information.
Yeah, and Padilla was actually called in to testify, and Padilla pled the fifth rather than get up there and testify in front of a judge and jury. And that happened with somebody from the DA's office also. They were also called in and implicated in some of the drug smuggling charges, and they pled the fifth, and they were promptly arrested or promptly fired rather by the district attorney, you know, saying, I can't have somebody working for me who can't get up in front of a judge and jury and tell the truth. But the sheriff chose to keep Padilla on and employed. So that was interesting. And then so then he did finally fire him after he was indicted.
That's what it takes. That's where the bar is.
Yeah. So the rumors are that there are more indictments, sealed indictments, so we're waiting to see what happens next. So there will be another year of interesting corruption scandals in Hidalgo County.
It just keeps coming. I mean, it started a while ago.
Yeah, it just keeps happening, so we'll see what happens.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. Melissa has been reporting extensively about the increase of Central American refugees fleeing violence and crossing the border into the U.S. Melissa, how is this story evolving as we head into 2014?
Well, there's actually more people coming across, especially women and children. And what's happening is they're fleeing gang violence in Central America, which has really skyrocketed the amount of violence down there. And a lot of these kids and women and families are coming through Texas because Texas is the shortest distance from Central America. And historically, it's the most traveled route for Central Americans. So we had so many kids coming across, and these were unaccompanied kids, to such an extent that the nonprofits that normally and government groups that normally take care of these kids had to reach out to some military bases, a military base in San Antonio, to house some of the kids. I think they had 100 kids staying there at one point. And this trend doesn't seem to be getting any lesser. It's actually, I think, increasing. There was just a story that came out in The Guardian about how Mexico is also seeing a huge increase in people from Central America coming over who are applying for asylum in Mexico as well. It's more than doubled, and they're not really equipped to deal with it. It really caught off, people here in the U.S. were really caught off guard by it also, and I think they have now expanded the number of shelters for Central American kids now, where I think they feel like they can house them somewhat if it doesn't increase even more. So there's seems to be a real crisis with the violence going on down there, and I think that's something that we're going to continue to see this year, and we're going to see more migrants coming in Texas.
Go ahead. Well, it's a really interesting timing, I guess, because you know, since the the economic downturn of the last few years, the story, you know, that I think has been out there the most kind of sort of in the big picture is that, you know, illegal crossings into the U.S. have been going down. Like the U.S. has been seen as a, you know, less desirable place to be necessarily, or fewer job opportunities. But maybe those are just numbers of people coming directly from Mexico. I mean, this, you know, crossing, you know, from Central America, I think is an aspect of the story that's really kind of been hidden.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that you brought that up, actually, because you're right. There, it's the unprecedented lowest number in so many decades of people actually crossing the border, undocumented people. But there's these two anomalies, being the Central American migrants who are coming because of the violence, and it's mostly a Texas phenomenon. They're coming through the Rio Grande Valley mostly. So as you're seeing, like, these really historically low rates of people crossing in traditional areas like Arizona, we've actually, like, tripled in the valley where people are coming across from Central America. So it's this anomaly compared to the rest of the border. The other trend, which is unfortunate, is the number of people coming from Mexico are seeking asylum. So it's this interesting thing where you have these... We have the most people coming from Central America that we've had since the 80s, when they had the civil wars and they had the fights between the dictatorships and the left-wing guerrillas. We now have a similar migration going on, but it's because of gang violence and because of organized crime, which has been going on in Mexico too, and has sort of been pushed down from Mexico. I think this sort of battle between the organized crime groups, the cartels, and it's really destabilized these sort of weak democratic governments, and people are finding that they have no security, that the government can't protect them, the law enforcement are corrupt and in, you know, working with the cartels, so they're actually fleeing for their lives. So we're seeing this these two things going on, with the Central Americans coming and then also seeking asylum in Mexico, and then you have the Mexicans seeking asylum in the United States as well.
And those asylum cases from Mexico are notoriously hard to win. Right?
Notoriously hard, and those have actually doubled in the last year, the number of people seeking asylum. And this is also a very important story for Texas, because a lot of these asylum cases come through Texas, because we have such a large border with Mexico, and we see so many people coming through the state. So yeah, we're going to see a lot more people seeking asylum here.
Are there any signs of change in the system as far as from asylum or maybe kids coming across from Central America? Either one of those, but as far as the system getting ready to deal with the change in the demands?
It seems like both Mexico and the United States have responded very slowly and reluctantly to these trends. There has been some talk about reforming some of the asylum laws with the immigration reform package, but there's often, I think, a disconnect between the people who are advocating for immigration reform and the people who want to see asylum laws reformed and changed as well. I think some immigration advocates feel like they already have such a battle just getting immigration reform done that they worry about the asylum question. And, you know, we've seen a lot of, like, sort of right-wing blogs lately and conservatives talking about how immigrants are abusing the asylum system. They really just want to come here, and they really don't do it because they need asylum. I've been seeing that a lot lately in you know, out there in the conservative world. And having written quite a bit about the asylum issue, especially for Mexicans, it's a very difficult system. And typically you'll spend several months in a detention facility. It's not pleasant whatsoever. And I couldn't imagine anybody ever wanting to claim asylum so that they could get a foothold in the United States. I mean, everybody I've ever interviewed would much rather stay in their own country. I mean, because they had to give up everything to come here.
Yeah.
So it's a real struggle, and they have to start over again, and it's just not something you would wish on anybody.
And perhaps even worse for minors.
Yeah, and incredibly difficult for minors, trying to navigate a really labyrinth of immigration courts and laws and shelters, and it's just extremely difficult.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. And for the last week and a half or so, we've been counting down the top stories of 2013 on TexasObserver.org. We've spent the last year covering topics like police brutality, sexism at the Capitol, the tragic consequences of unchecked doctors. There's been a lot. And the story that really stands out the most for me is Rachel Pearson's piece, Texas's Other Death Penalty. We talked about this on the show a few weeks ago, and this was a first-person account of a UTMB med student and what was happening at her all-volunteer free clinic in Galveston. And a lot of what she had to say was pretty heart-wrenching, I thought. What did you guys think about this?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was great because it really laid bare this whole sort of fallacy that you know, either Democrats or Republican legislators always say, well, if you don't have health insurance, you
just
know, you'll go to the ER,
right,
and they'll see you there. But that's not true.
Right.
You know, the whole argument rests on this sort of faulty logic, you know, and her piece really lays bare the truth of the situation that if you do have a chronic illness, you know, like cancer,
you won't get treated.
You're not going to get treated. You're
right.
Going to get treated like a ping pong ball and passed from one ER to another, or, you know, they'll send you to a clinic. So basically the clinic that she works in is like the last of the it's the final stop,
right,
for these patients who have been, you know, kicked from one place to the next. And it's just a really heartbreaking story.
Yeah, her role in all of that, to be the person at that last stop who has to say, well, I'm doing the best I can for you, knowing all the time that she doesn't have the resources and she doesn't have the trained colleagues there to really handle the kind of stuff that they've been saddled with.
Yeah, here's a little clip from our interview with Rachel.
I wrote about a few patients that I've seen who have suffered really extremely from not being able to get comprehensive care for their diseases. A couple of patients who have died from cancers while being cared for by students here at St. Vincent's. And not only is the problem with UTMBs moving away from providing charity care, but the problem is also with state policy decisions. And I write about how we were hoping when the Affordable Care Act started to come into action, we were hoping that the model of care that we provide would drastically change and that we would be able to get most of our patients on insurance and we would have fewer patients and they'd all be able to get what they needed medically. But unfortunately, because Texas declined to expand Medicaid, most of our patients who are, you know, working class and poor people are still without insurance and will not be able to afford insurance even under the Affordable Care Act.
Well, the pieces I want to mention are a two-part series that we ran in the latter half of the year on brutality and impunity in the Houston Police Department. And these are both by Emily DePrang and involved a whole lot of records research and things that really hadn't seen the light of day before, but she was able to take a look at, you know, what sort of things get you disciplined as a police officer in Houston, and then how often you can get off in you know, arbitration hearings, and at the end of all the disciplinary procedures sort of end up with your job and a slap on the wrist. It turns out that happens a whole lot,
right?
As do shootings by police officers. In her second story, she got into just how rampant that stuff is in Houston, and it's pretty sobering, and I think that it's had a real impact in Houston, too.
Yeah, let's listen to a clip from our interviews with Emily.
You know, I mean, a lot of times when you hear about police brutality, or, you know, you'll hear that people say, oh, well, you know, it's somebody that they're just crying police brutality because they're a criminal and they want, you know, they want to get back at police, or they want, you know, or citizens, you know, seeing a video of something that may appear to be brutality, they just don't understand the situation, they don't know what it's like for the police. But when you've got 118 complaints by other police officers that are saying, no, that wasn't cool, that wasn't appropriate, that wasn't protect and serve. What I witnessed was excessive force. When you've got 118 officers who are willing to say that about other officers, that's how many internal complaints they had. And you've got to remember that there's no way to make an anonymous complaint at HPD. These are not people who can come forward and settle a grudge or get back at somebody. They are suffering the social ramifications and by some accounts, the safety ramifications of reporting other officers for excessive force.
One of the stories that really stood out for me this year was the Texas Legislature's Sexist Little Secret by Olivia Messer, mm-hmm. which really was, I think, an issue that anybody, I worked in the legislature for 5 years, it's pretty evident once you walk in the door just what a macho kind of sexist scene is going on inside the under the pink dome. And Olivia really just opened that all up. It's a topic that I think any reporter knows, but you don't write about it. Like, it's typically not written about. And so Olivia really got into what goes on with the sexism, how really there are still so few women legislators and how these women legislators are treated, and also, you know, this sort of war that's been going on against women's reproductive rights and why does that happen? And then you see what the legislature is like and just how sexist it is, and then you can sort of understand why there's been all these attacks on reproductive rights lately.
Yeah, she really did a nice job of sort of connecting the two things. And one, the sort of story that's a story of the legislature that goes back a long time, and then that sets that up sort of as one of the answers as to, well, how could the legislature, you know, come into the situation where you have a lot of people who don't, you know, a lot of men who don't understand a lot of the stuff that they're legislating and can't answer a lot of kind of basic scientific questions about the stuff. You know, in a situation like this, and it's because of, you know, this atmosphere that's existed there for a long time.
Yeah.
And of course, the flip side to all of that is now we have two prominent female positions running for key positions in Texas.
Yeah. I mean, we've got Wendy Davis running for governor. We've got Leticia Vandepute running for lieutenant governor. So I think this is one of the first times that we have two women running at the top of the ticket, and it would be huge in Texas if we were to have a female governor, because I think we've only had two. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's it.
Yep.
And we've never had a Latina lieutenant governor. I'm absolutely sure of that. So that would just be huge if that were to happen. And of course, Wendy Davis and Leticia Vandepute were instrumental in the filibuster that happened back in June. The filibuster heard around the world, and that really sort of jettisoned Wendy Davis into the national spotlight and, you know, helped her raise a lot of money and get a lot of national attention for her race. And it certainly helped Senator Vandepute as well. So it's going to be a real interesting year, I think, to see how that race goes and see Senator Davis run against Greg Abbott, who is really sort of the archetypal male candidate. You know, I mean, he was on Texas Monthly with a rifle slung over his shoulder. Right. You know, you don't get much more macho than that. So,
I mean, I think two fallouts then from you know, that time in the legislature that would be really interesting. There's Wendy Davis and Leticia Vandepute running right now, and then also the question of, you know, is anything going to be any different in the legislature when they meet again? You know, after such high profile you know, publicity around just the sexist nature of a lot of what happens there.
I'm going to be a pessimist and say no, unless they change the makeup of the legislators. If we get more women in there, we get more progressive minds in there. If we had a female governor, yeah, I think you'd see a big change. But if there's not a change in the makeup of the legislative body, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of difference, unfortunately. That's my pessimistic...
Well, thank you for sharing.
I'm not sure
you're welcome.
Reason to argue with that.
Yeah. Well, we've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you out there for listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.